being connected to a fish that big is an experience, and it's so fun.
And then after that jump, it came off, and it was bad. It was huge. They think it was like around 300 pounds, something like that.
Believe me, there's so many times that I have had, like, I know I had a great shot, but the cameras weren't cooperating in that moment. It's like,
you see them turn on it, you see the puff of mud, and you're just like, it's on, and then they just take off.
Welcome to another episode of Wildlife Outdoors with Jose and Russell, and today we are joined by Erica Lynn Simmons. She is an avid outdoors person. She likes to fish. She likes, she also engages in homesteading, so she does a lot of meal prep. She grows her own foods and things like that, which we'll dive into more in this episode, so it should be a fantastic one. Thank you for joining us, Erica. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you guys so much for having me. I appreciate it. I'm excited.
Of course. Thank you for hopping on. We're excited to have you. So we talked a little bit about off the podcast about how you, you know, fish and bow fish a little bit. And we had an episode actually early on about bow fishing, so we can get into that in a little bit, and homesteading, whatever else. So is that something that you've done majority of your life, or?
So majority of my life, I have actually been fishing. I grew up fishing in New York. Ever since I was little, my pop-up would have me out there real little on the boat, fishing for fluke and flounder. Pretty much every weekend we'd be out there fishing, with my grandparents. He passed away in my teens. So at that point I kind of stopped fishing for a little while still living in Pennsylvania. And then more recently, the last 10 years, I've moved down to Florida, and I wanted to get back out on the water again because I knew it was in my blood. So it's been pretty much my life ever since. I just can't get enough of it. So I've been doing a lot more of the saltwater game. I do a little dabble in from freshwater, but that's usually where you'll find me is out on the water these days.
That's awesome. So I see that you have pretty consistent posts on your videos. Do you have like a backlog of videos, or are you just out there that much?
I try to get out there as much as possible. No, I don't really have a backlog, to be honest. I try to get stuff posted as soon as I get it. In terms of the YouTube stuff, I do all my own editing. So usually I need a week turnaround time to transition all the hours worth of footage into Premiere Pro and then get everything uploaded into YouTube. But I pretty much get stuff out as soon as I catch them. So I like to keep along with, obviously, throughout the seasons here in Florida, there's different species that are bigger and kind of hitting more at certain times of the year. So right now, for example, black drum are really hot. I've had a couple really cool videos catching some black drum on YouTube. Tarpon are about to start showing up again, so I'm going to be hopefully getting out there on the fly with the fly rod. Hopefully I can get something to work on video, but it's really cool, estuary and all the fish that move around through Tampa, because there's so many different species to target, so many different ways to target them. So it really keeps my content really interesting, and there's always something new to go do. So it is really fun. I get to do a lot of different things, kind of targeting a lot of different species.
So the YouTube thing to me is like incredibly fascinating. I know Russell's been getting more into it here recently, and it's pretty cool because, like, growing up, I used to watch like hunting and fishing shows with my grandfather on TV, but that was kind of limited. Now with YouTube, you have like free reign. You can look up whatever you want. There's so many content creators out there, and they're putting out some fantastic stuff. So I have a couple questions for you regarding like the YouTube scene, I guess, if you will. I guess the first thing would be, what made you decide to take that plunge into making YouTube videos?
That's a great question, because to be honest, there's a period of time where I really just didn't want to get into the YouTube thing because it is a lot of work, especially when it comes to the editing side, as I'm sure you guys know. It was around COVID, when COVID hit. I was furloughed from my full-time job, so I'd actually made a couple videos at that point, but it had taken me so long to edit because I was just kind of doing it in my free time after work and on weekends when I wanted to be out on the water fishing. So it took me a while to have the time to edit. Once COVID hit and I was furlowed, I didn't have work anymore. So it kind of gave me that time to be able to deep dive into YouTube get a bunch of videos like popping out. And at that point, I'm like, hey, I'm getting a video out almost every week. Like, I'm really starting to see a lot of exposure here. And YouTube really started to take off at that point. So that was really off, kind of in a nice way. I was furloughed from work because it gave me that time to really be able to jumpstart the whole YouTube game. And then I really had a realization that I'm like, wow, this could actually like work out if I'm able to do this more full time. So once I got back into the workflow and they let everyone back in the offices, YouTube was starting to really take off at that point. So it was kind of the point where I am missing out on opportunities that I could be taking right now with like certain sponsors and stuff if I had the time to designate to doing more YouTube, more content creation stuff. So kind of got to the point where I'm like, you know what, I'm going to quit my job and just kind of jump in this full time, see what I can do with it. Cause right now it is starting to blow up. So now's the time for me to kind of capitalize on this if I can get something like this to continue rolling. Cause again, YouTube is kind of the cash cow when it comes to like social media platforms, Instagram, mm-hmm. not so much. So YouTube is really kind of where the money is. So since I was able to get that going so good at the beginning there, I'm like, let's just do this, jump in this full time and see what I can do. And I haven't looked back since. I definitely don't regret it. It's working for myself at this point is really awesome. So YouTube is definitely a big decision at first, but I'm really glad I jumped into it.
That's so awesome. So I don't know if how Russell feels with what I'm about to say, but for me personally, like I've thought about trying to put out some like YouTube videos and things like that. But number one, like you had mentioned, I mean, I can only imagine how much of a time commitment it is to not only record the content, but to edit everything and put out a product that you're happy with. Like I can mm-hmm. only imagine just how difficult and how much detail is involved with that. But also for me, like it's fishing is like a way for me to kind of escape for a little bit. And mm-hmm. the thought of bringing like a camera and all this stuff to go and do this thing, like it to me is kind of like a distraction. And I kind of want to keep those things separated. So that's kind of been the biggest thing for me or that's been preventing me from wanting to kind of explore that a little bit. But for you, has going into YouTube full time affected the way that you feel about fishing or the way that you perceive it? Like, is it still like fun for you, something you enjoy doing on your free time, or does it feel more like work now?
Yeah, that's a good question. It definitely at times feels like work, but I just love just being out on the water alone, whether or not I'm catching fish, whether or not a YouTube video is working out. I'm just enjoying myself because I look back at the times that I'm like, hey, I could be sitting in a cubicle right now. Like, this is way better than working for someone else. You know, even if the fish aren't biting, believe me, there's plenty of times that I've been out fishing with the GoPros and the wind's kicking my ass. Like, I'm not catching anything. Like, it's just a terrible like fishing day, but it's still like, I have to remind myself, like, this is way better than working in an office. Like, this is what you want. Like, don't forget, like, this is like the dream. People were like, I get people to say all the time, like, that's so cool you do that for a living. Like, you have the best job ever. Like, you're so lucky. It's like, you know, like I am, like, I've worked myself so far at this point, like it's worth it, you know? So yeah. At certain times, yeah, it's definitely like, it definitely feels like work sometimes, but it's still like, I'm out on the water. I couldn't be asking for anything else.
See, I found myself feeling that way because I haven't filmed too many videos, and the videos when I do film, I try to do more of a documentary style mm-hmm. Is what I'm trying to get into. But in the past, whenever I've done fishing videos, it was a lot less, I guess, work you could say, because I would almost do like a set it and forget it type of filming, which it seems like yours is a lot like you'll have your GoPro setups. You have your probably a chesty and then the one on your boat, on the back of your boat. And so you can get the footage, but you're not having to have camera in hand. Right.
Right.
So there's been times where it's like, okay, I would set my GoPro on the pole on the back of my kayak and I'll have the one on my chest. And then I'm just, you know, going and doing my own thing, not really paying too much attention about the filming aspect of it. There's always that thing in the back of my mind where it's like, oh, I hope I get a good, you know, top water take over here so I can get it on film. But mm-hmm. it never really hinders my experience out there fishing, doing that style of filming. Is that similar for you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I totally feel 100%. I try to keep the GoPros kind of out of the way as much as possible. In the middle of things, I'll kind of talk here and there, but I find it easy to, kind of like you said, if you have the cameras in the background, you can always do voiceover stuff later. You can always kind of do a kind of like an interview type of setup, how you can like go back and forth between like an interview front and then like action front. But getting fishing on film is definitely tricky because you don't know where the fish is going to bite. You don't know where it's going to run to. And that's your action shot. So it definitely takes, it's a love hate relationship when it comes to trying to film fishing because it's not absolutely easy. So it's fun though. I love it. And I, like I said, I wouldn't want to be doing anything else.
I mean, you brought up some great points. And so in your videos, like when you're trying to record and get content, have you ever had a shot or something happen that you wish you would have captured that you didn't? And does that hurt? Does missing the shot hurt almost as much as missing a good fish? Like, I can only imagine like it's got to be fairly similar, I can, to some degree anyway.
Oh yeah, I mean all the time. more than you realize. Where I'll like think that it's record. Oh, what's the worst is I'll have the GoPros, everything's recording, like everything's good. Middle of an action shot, fish is on, beep 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 beep. Like oh, battery died, or beep beep beep, overheated, or like because it's Florida, it's so hot out here. GoPros overheat so fast, it's crazy. Because I have to pretty much have them recording at all times to catch the action shot because I don't know when the fish is going to bite. So the GoPros like running for so long, they tend to overheat after a while, especially with the sun. So believe me, there's so many times that I have had, like, I know I had a great shot, but the cameras weren't cooperating in that moment. It's like, dang it. Start over. Hold on, fish. Like, don't just stop there for a second. Let me mess around with GoPro batteries. Like, it's definitely a little tricky. I've definitely lost a lot of good shots. But at least, like, if I don't get it on video, at least I'll like set my phone up and get a picture. So at least I'm getting like a picture of the fish. So at least in some way, I'm getting some kind of content. If it doesn't work out for the GoPro stuff, then, oh, well, I may not be able to make a video out of it, but at least I can get some pictures and get some content.
So that's really interesting. I never thought about it until you mentioned it. Like, I guess with other YouTube content, like if someone's in the middle of making something and it goes wrong, potentially, depending on what's being done, you can redo it. But with outdoor, like recreational type of content, like hunting and fishing, once an opportunity comes and goes, like it's gone. You can't rewind it. You can't recreate it. It's just, man, I never thought about it like that. So now I just have like a whole nother respect for outdoor YouTubers because that's stressful.
Especially the hunting stuff. Like I know you see the deer. This isn't mine. It's my husband. But especially when it comes to the hunting stuff, like if you don't have those cameras in the right spot, the right time, like you're not getting those shots. We have the hunting channel always on TV here. And it's, I specifically, cause you're mentioning it, there's been multiple times that I'll even think about like, dang, that really sucks. Your cameras didn't work out. Cause they'll say like, oh, blah, blah happened, but the cameras weren't ready. Like, and just had to do an audio voiceover to kind of explain what happened. It's like instant, similar scenarios with these outdoor shows and outdoor content that it comes and goes quick. And if you don't have the cameras ready, you're going to miss it.
I've even heard of like some people, like they won't even take the shot because the cameras aren't on the subject. So they'll just let the animal walk, whatever. They'll let that opportunity just pass by because the cameras weren't ready. Like that's gotta be gut wrenching, especially if it's like a beautiful, you know, like the animal that they need and they just let it walk. Like it's wild.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So on those days, so you're doing YouTube full time and everything now. So on those days that you're having rough days, like you mentioned before, that are not good fishing days where it's really, really hard to get content. Like how, as a full-time YouTuber, do you cope with that? And I guess kind of related, like what does your process as a YouTuber look like day to day? Like, do you go in there with, I guess, an idea of what you want to shoot, or are you just kind of going out there and just seeing what happens and hoping to get some stuff or like a little bit of everything? Like, how does that all that like work together?
Yeah, good question. So usually I'll have a game plan for the day of what I'm going to be trying to target, whether I'm going to stop at the bait shop and get myself some shrimp to try to get on some like black drum or some sheephead, or if I'm planning to bring like the fly rod and I'll plan to just target some redfish on the flats in some of my spots. Usually I kind of have a game plan. I try to do some sort of intro in the beginning to try to explain what I'm going to be doing, hopefully. But it doesn't always work out like that. So sometimes I will end up having to redo my intro or retake certain things to kind of match more with what I end up catching that day, because it doesn't always work out. So like, all right, I'm going to go for redfish and I only catch snook that day. It's like, okay, well, now I have to make this a snook video. So there's definitely times where I have to change things on the fly. But usually I have a general idea of what I'm going to be trying to target that day. So it kind of makes it a little easier to work with the flow of what I'm doing to try to get B-roll and try to have camera shots in spots where I think the fish are going to bite to try to get like the max, like kind of maximize my video footage. Because again, the B-roll is really great, but it's not always easy to capture some of that stuff. So I usually will have two or three GoPros going on at one time in different angles, you know, to try to get any shot that I could possibly get in that moment.
So you've touched a little bit on fly, bait, conventional stuff like that. And then you said, hopefully you get a tarpon on the fly this upcoming season. Have you got a tarpon on the fly yet?
I have not. No, tarpon on fly is on my bucket list. And I have, as you guys know, I have my South Dade skiff. I have a little 16-foot poling skiff, the trolling motor on the front and the pole and stuff. But I haven't put a tarpon on the boat yet, so that's gonna be a goal again this year. So try to get a tarpon on fly. I mean, we catch them in the bay using, like, you know, your crabs that float on those outgoing tides. That we'll scoop crabs and throw those out for tarpon, or they bite really good on chunk bait. So we'll get a bunch of thread fins, chunk them up, and drift them out around the bridges. For tarpon, but never on fly. So that's going to be a goal this year. Keep your fingers crossed for me, because I'm going to need it. But yeah,
that's definitely a bucket fish for me. And I got invited last year to go down to Florida actually to fish for tarpon. And awesome. I would have had to pay for a guide. And I'm not as confident in my abilities enough to throw, you know, a couple grand down on a trip. It's like, I don't want to pay that money and then get out there and be like, you know, I'm the issue here. The fish is there. I just can't get it. So, yeah, I need to, you know, be a little bit better in my casting abilities before I actually jump and try to go target tarpon on the fly. But it definitely is one of my bucket list fish.
But you've gotten tarpon though, right? On like conventional? Mm-mm. No, nope. Never?
Nope. Never. I've never actually even seen a tarpon. So
what? You got to come down to Tampa. You'll see it. It's crazy. Like during their migrations up the coast, once that water starts warming up, they move from the Keys up along the west coast of Florida. And it's wild. Like they'll just come in these huge schools along the beach and they just do these like rotating donuts. And it's in the first light in the morning, you see them like tailing and you see them like coming up for air. It's so cool. It's seeing a fish that big, well, that many fish that big around you. I swear, like, granted, I haven't caught one on fly yet, but I'll be up there and I'm shaking. Like, I'm so nervous when I start to see them coming up and I have a shot on them, especially on fly, or I mean, even conventional, I'll be throwing dead stuff at them. And I'm like, oh my God, it's so big. That's so crazy, because it's like the amount. They're so strong. Like, I mean, you guys know that they get huge. So, I mean, they could push you up for a couple hour long fight, and get being connected to a fish that big is an experience. And it's so fun. Especially when you see them jumping and stuff and doing all their acrobatic stuff. It's a thrill. So fingers crossed I can get that to happen on fly this year, but you guys definitely need to come down and do some fly and do some tarpon fishing. It will be definitely a bucket list thing that you guys will never forget.
Yep. I definitely plan on doing it. I was down in Key West last week and I was just hoping to see some and I didn't see any. Wow. And I did a little bit of fishing in the Bahamas on Grand Bahama Island, trying to do some bonefish. But the water was just really rough and there was no sight fishing available. I was fishing the surf and it wasn't going to happen. But yeah, bonefish and tarpon are two of my hopefully soon ones that I will get on. But tarpon is definitely like lifetime bucket list fish I want to get on the fly.
I know they come in Texas. Like I've heard people catching them off the jetties here in Texas. Mm-hmm. I've never seen one, but yeah, tarpon's really high on my bucket list fish too. Like, oh man, there's a video put out by Yeti. I think it's called like 120 days or something like that. Beautiful video, but the tarpon, man, I just get so excited. Like I get pumped. I want to catch tarpon so bad. But hearing you talk about tarpon, Erica, you seem very passionate about it. How can you recall your first tarpon that you ever caught? Like, what was that like?
My first tarpon I ever caught, I honestly think was down in the Keys. Now that you were mentioning the Keys, we were doing some night fishing actually around a bridge, and the shrimp were flushing that night. So basically, like when you hear people, and for people that don't know, when you hear people talking about like, oh, the shrimp are flushing or the crabs are flushing, when you get that outgoing tide, especially the big hill tides where it's a lot of movement all at one time, a lot of either the shrimp or the crabs that are in and around like the grass, they get pulled off of that grass so quickly because, or they get pulled off because the water is moving so quickly. And then you're going to end up seeing, especially around the bridges, the way that the water moves, they end up just floating on top as that outgoing tide is pushing them out. And now, of course, it's perfect bait that these fish feed on that. So you'll see, or at night, for example, when you're tarpon fishing, you'd hear them, the tarpon coming up and slurping the shrimp off the surface of the water. So it's a really, really cool experience. And then to be able to then just take a dip net and you just scoop the shrimp off the top of the water, where here in Tampa, we get the crabs that flush. So we'll just go around and scoop up all this bait. And then you take that bait and you tie it up to a hook and chuck it out, let that drift back with the tide like it naturally is doing. And that's where I caught, that was my first tarpon at night. So I didn't get to see all of like the jumps and stuff, but it was a really, really cool experience. It was small enough. I think it was under 40 inches. So it's a size that you're allowed to bring on the boat. Once they get a lot larger, it's not, you're not supposed to take them out of the water. So it was cool that I was able to actually take it out of the water, get a cool picture with it. So that was a really cool experience. But I've caught a couple of real big ones down around Boca on the West Coast with some friends, ones that put me on a fight for over an hour. So I've done both ways, the ones that take a couple minutes to fight, and the ones that take a lot longer. I've had my butt kicked a couple times, even here in Tampa with some friends and some guides that have taken us tarpon fishing. But the big ones, they'll put you up for a fight. You gotta be ready for those. But no, it's really fun.
See, I've never fought a fish for that long before. The longest I've ever fought a fish was I caught a 54-inch bull red in Venice, Louisiana, a couple years ago. It was awesome. But I fought it for about 40 minutes, so never reached the hour mark. But even then, and I caught it on a 9-weight fly rod, and my forearm was just completely balled up, just trying to, because I had to end up horsing on it, because redfish, you know, they like to dig. And we're out there in the flats in Venice, and it would go out, and we weren't in the flats. We were in some, a little bit deeper water. We were chasing them in the flats, and it took us, and it was just, I'd get it close to the boat and it would dig, and then it would go under the boat, and then I'd have to go around the front of the boat, and then it would take off again, and then I'd bring it back and it started digging again. And my arm was just killing me. I actually ended up, so I may have already had tendonitis in my elbow, but it got so much worse after fighting that fish for like 4 months. My elbow was killing me. I couldn't even like really hold my cast iron skillet up with my right arm. It was nuts.
That's funny. Yeah. I haven't caught a redfish that big on flies. So that's definitely going to be a bucket list to get up to Venice. Because they got some big reds up there, so it's gonna definitely be a trip I gotta head up there to do.
Oh, you definitely should. When you're talking earlier about getting nervous with the tarpon and stuff when you see them rolling the first time, so the one that I caught was actually smaller than the first one that I hooked. And the first one that I hooked, it almost pulled me off the casting platform. I dropped my rod in the water. By the time I got it picked up, the line was wrapped around the reel. I mean, it was a nightmare. And so she broke me off almost immediately. But I was shaking so much that I told my buddy, I said, hey, man, you got to take the platform. I'm shaking too much. I couldn't even cast. I couldn't even stand up on the platform. I was so nervous.
That's awesome. That sounds like fun though to me. Help us sign me up. No, that's awesome. Have you done any sword fishing while you were in Venice?
Mm-mm.
No,
I want to though.
Yeah, and the tuna up there get huge. I haven't done the tuna, but I've done the sword fishing, and it's they make some big fish up there.
Really, that would be awesome. Jose's caught tuna before, but was it on the fly or no?
No. No, a buddy of mine, I wish that'd be sick. No, a buddy of mine I went to school with in Kingsville. His family had a boat. They would do tournaments and stuff like that. And I think this was pre-COVID. He had called me and they were going to do their last run of the season before I guess it got too rough, or I'm not exactly sure what, but they were going out for their last run of the season. And they needed one more spot to fill. So he called me and he said, hey, man, you want to go on a tuna run? We heard that they're biting and we want to try and get out there before we can't go out there anymore. I was like, dude, I've never been deep sea fishing like that before. I am down. So took the opportunity. We went to Port A, I believe is where we left out of. We drove 150 miles offshore. And I get seasick.
Oh, no.
I do fine. Oh yeah, I do. I'm fine in the bays. I'm fine in the flats. I'm fine on lakes, but offshore, big boats, it messes me up bad. But I was like, dude, I knew this. I knew I got sick, but I had like Dramamine and all that stuff. But I was like, man, I don't know when I'm going to get an opportunity like this again. So regardless if I get sick or not, I'm toughing it out. I'm going. So sure enough, like after the first 4 hours. I was already chumming the waters. It was terrible.
Oh,
so I just like, I, there was like a, they had this big cooler on the back of the boat. I climbed up on there and I crashed I slept the whole way. Cause that was the only way that I could not throw up. So I remember waking up and they're getting lines and everything ready. We're already at this oil rig. There's another boat there. They're dropping lines. They're hooking up the tuna. And so we just started dropping lines and stuff, and we're catching yellowfin. I think the biggest one that trip was like 120 pounds, something like that. And it was awesome. I had never seen water that blue before. I had never seen, like, on the run out there, because there's no light pollution, I had never seen the sky lit up like it was. It was gorgeous. There's hardly anything that makes you feel so small. And when you're out in the middle of the ocean with no lights, nothing around you except the lights from the stars, from the sky. It was incredible. Incredible. Never forget that. But so we're fighting these tuna, catching these tuna. And one guy actually hooked up to a marlin. I think it was a blue marlin. And it was like something from a movie. I just remember it was only on briefly, but I remember breaking the surface. Like, it had jumped and it was massive. And I just remember seeing the colors. It was unreal. Like, I never would have thought I had the opportunity to experience that before. Just seeing the fish made the trip for me. It was beautiful. And then after that jump, it came off. And it was bad. It was huge. They think it was like around 300 pounds, something like that. Well, to me, it was huge. I don't know how big blue marlin get, but they're it was pretty neat. So we ended up going back, and we get back to the dock and the captain's filleting all the fish, and huge, huge tuna steaks. And he looked at me, he goes, you ever had like fresh tuna, like right off the fish? I was like, nah. He goes, dude, try this. And he cut off this little piece. I can't remember where from, but it was like a little sliver, and he gave it to me. And it was so, I don't even know how to describe it. It didn't taste like fish at all. It was like, it tasted like the ocean. It was just so fresh. And it was so tender, just like almost dissolved in your mouth. It was the most delectable bite I think I've ever taken from any fish. It was awesome. That's been my only deep sea trip ever. I mean, I've gone like on those, what do they call those little party boats, party barges, whatever. But I don't really count that. This was just like a whole nother level. So Brandon, if I don't know if you listen to our podcast at all, but you know, just thank you. That was awesome. But that's been my only experience doing anything like that. I hope to do it again with the fly rod in hand. It'd be awesome to get a tuna or a cobia or sailfish, something out there on the fly. I think it'd be a lot of fun, but yeah, it's been my only experience so far. It was a blast.
That's awesome. How was that tuna fight? Was it pretty long?
About 20, 30 minutes, but they had like some pretty big gear, heavy lines. It wasn't as long as I thought it would be, surprisingly. The big one, obviously, yeah.
Not like Wicked Tuna where it's like they're trying to
But we also weren't catching anything that big, but because the biggest one was like an anomaly. The other ones were like, I don't know, between 60, 80 pounds, something like that. I can't remember, but it was a blast. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I haven't caught any of those tunas up in like Venice, like those big ones. But we do some like small ones down around like Tampa and the Keys, but nothing that big. That would be a first.
Have y'all heard about the tuna market in Japan?
Dude, it's insane. Some of those fish sell for like millions of dollars.
What kind of tuna are you talking about?
It's I'm not sure what kind of tuna it is, but and I mean the documentary I watched was a long time ago, but essentially I guess during what they might call the tuna season, like I think it's like a kind of a tradition that the first fish are generally sold for more money. I guess it's kind of like a thing out of respect. I can't remember some type of tradition, but they grade them on like fat content and all these other things. And I think there was one year they sold a tuna. I can't remember what kind of tuna it was, but they sold one for over $1 million. Just one fish.
Yeah.
I'm in the wrong profession.
You got to catch one fish and you can make money for a couple of years.
Right.
And I think the grade of that fish is what makes the difference, obviously, in the cost. But you think if they're buying a fish for $1 million, think about how much they're selling. Like if they're making sushi with it or something like that, like, could you imagine how expensive the product itself is if they're buying the fish for $1 million?
Yeah, that's insane. Wild.
Yeah. Yeah, the tuna thing is crazy. And then what is that species of tuna? Is it big eye? I can't remember, but there's this one, like they hang around like Nova Scotia, the colder waters, but they get like hundreds of pounds. They get massive. I can't remember what those things are called. But I saw a video, there was a woman, she was out fishing by herself and she caught this massive tuna. It was a couple hundred pounds, like 300-400 pounds. And she was able to get it on the boat by herself, like in the middle of nowhere. I was like, Jesus Christ, that's insane.
Go, girl.
Right?
Dude.
Have y'all seen those videos of the people that catch the small tunas and they'll hold them and they just start like shaking like crazy? Just the amount of power those fish have is insane. I couldn't even imagine the fight on a fly with one of those.
They are built so cool, man. Like their fins are like recessed into the bodies to make them streamline like little torpedoes. Yes. And then those little ridges on the tail so it can like pivot and turn, so they can just turn on a dime. The physiology of tunas is insane.
Yeah, and they taste delicious. That's too. Nuts. I'm a sushi person.
I am too. I freaking love sushi.
I do love sushi. Yeah, the yellowtail sushi. Oh, so good. I just ate dinner, but it already sounds really good.
I haven't eaten dinner yet, and I'm already hungry. Jose was talking about the fish earlier.
I know you're having for dinner tonight.
Right.
Sushi.
So there's a place in San Marcos, Texas. The first time that I ever had sushi, because I've never really been a huge fish fan in terms of eating it. And there's a place in San Marcos, Texas called Sakura, and they had a sushi train. And I think it was Monday through Wednesday or Wednesday through Friday from 2 to 3 o'clock. They had all you can eat sushi train for $13 for a lunch thing. And so I went in there one time. I was like, yeah, that probably isn't going to be good, whatever, but you know, it is what it is. And so I went in there and it was really, really good sushi. And they would even make it for you. So if you sit down at the sushi train and say, you know, well, I want a crunchy roll or something that wasn't on there, they would actually make it for you and then put it on there and you can get it. You could order an entree from their menu and everything. It was all you can eat for $13. And so I would go like once a week. I was like, yeah, I freaking love sushi now.
Right? I don't know if I trust that. But as long as it's good.
Yeah, it was really good.
It was good. I remember Russell invited me to lunch there one time and we crushed some sushi, but it was, it was pretty good. As far as all you can eat sushi goes, it was pretty good.
Yeah.
Definitely better than like a buffet. Buffet sushi is not a fan of it.
Yeah, no, that's, I don't want, I need like to order sushi. if I'm going to eat that stuff.
Have you ever tried making your own sushi, Erica, from like the fishy off cotton stuff?
No, I even have like the little sushi roll thing and everything, like the bamboo thing to like roll them up. Mm-hmm. We'll do like sashimi stuff, you know, just do a like quick cut, like just pieces of fish, you know, but no, I'm not good when it comes to like rolling sushi. So that's one thing I haven't gotten good at. Do you guys make your own sushi ever?
I've always wanted to, but never have.
No.
No, I never have either. I'd like to. I think it looks fun. I'm afraid to screw it up.
Yeah. My thing is just getting the right consistency of the rice. Like I'm not the best rice cooker.
I can never make my rice either.
You got to cut the other stuff like real, real thin. Otherwise it's just the ratios aren't right. Yeah. I'm not that good when it comes to that kind of stuff. At least sashimi, like I said, just give me some plain raw fish. I'll eat that all day, but rolling it up. Yeah. I'll let someone else do that.
Have you ever tried ceviche?
Yeah. It's with like the lemon juice and stuff, right? With
Yes,
I have. I don't think I've made it, but I've eaten it at like restaurants or like if family or like friends will make it. And it's delicious. It's crazy how like you can cook something basically by just is it lemon juice or lime juice? I forget. But
lime. Some people do like a lime lemon mixture or like a splash of orange juice. But yeah, it's really good. Redfish makes a fantastic ceviche.
Really? I'll have to try that. Yeah. I don't usually keep redfish. It's funny, like out of all the redfish I catch, we kind of joke around and these are like our backyard pets. Like we got to come back and catch them tomorrow. So we don't usually take fish out of the bay to eat. Usually it's like my Keys trips or Venice. We'll keep the swordfish, you know, we'll do our meat trips elsewhere. We'll do the offshore stuff for like grouper and yellowtail snapper, things like that. But the inshore stuff between either redfish, snook, flounder, trout, we usually don't keep them. To be honest, but I will have to try the redfish sometime. I'll keep that in mind next time I keep one. I'll definitely have to try that with the ceviche.
Redfish ceviche is really good. I like eating redfish. I don't harvest very many fish. Granted, I live in Arkansas, so it's not very often that I get down to catch redfish as it is anyways. But I do really like redfish. It's one of my favorite fish to eat. Mm-hmm. And I actually shared a video that HEB. So do you know what HEB is, Erica? Mm-hmm. The grocery store?
No.
It's a grocery store in South and Central Texas. And the guy that founded it, his name was Henry Edward Butt. So it's his initials. And it's my favorite grocery store. It's the weirdest thing that, you know, it's people
greatest are going, grocery favorite, store.
Yeah. I have a favorite car. I have a favorite dog. I have a favorite grocery store and it's HEB. And I think the nearest one to me is like 8 hours away. So it sucks. But their produce is phenomenal. Their meat section, their seafood section, and they try to do everything responsibly using local farmers and stuff like that. Well, they recently released a video to do with redfish in the Texas coast, and it gave some history on how it was back in the day and then why there was such a redfish boom and why everybody started eating it so much. And they kind of go through the history of it and where the fishery stands now based on it. And it's pretty informative. It's entertaining to watch. But every time I see redfish or I see something to do with somebody catching redfish, it's like, God, I haven't had redfish in too long. I need to eat some redfish. It is just a really good fish to eat.
Yeah. So versatile.
Yeah. Anyway, it's definitely up there with one of those really, like you said, versatile fish. You can eat it however many ways you want.
Yeah. Have any of y'all ever had conch ceviche?
I have.
My roommate's from Puerto Rico and he's talked about it. I've never had the chance to try it.
Dude, it's good. I tried it in the Bahamas and it is really good. So I have a buddy named Brad who's from the Bahamas. And so he gave me like a list of things I had to try when I went there. And one of them was Vitamalt. It's like a malt beverage. It was pretty good. acquired taste, but pretty good. Goombay Punch, which is a soda that's brewed by, I think there's a Bohemian Coca-Cola company that's the only place that they make it, and it's really good. Some other local things that he told me to try, but he said I had to try the conch fritters and the conch salad. And so we went and we did the whole swimming with the pigs thing. And when we got back to the island, there was a guy who was almost doing like his own cooking show. It was interesting. So cool. He was explaining to you how to, you know, harvest the conch and the age of them and what age you want and how to tell if it's this or that, how to tell if it's a male or a female and stuff. Then he actually like did everything for you and taught you how to do it, taught you, you know, what vegetables go in it, what fruits you put into it and all that. And then he sold it for like $20 a bowl, which was insane, but it was really good. I bought a bowl and I was like, I got to try this. You know, Brad said I have to try this, so I'm trying this. And it was phenomenal. It was some of the best ceviche I've ever had. And it had onion, tomato, cucumbers. Of course, it had lemon and lime juice in it. I think he put a little bit of orange juice in it. He even chopped up some ghost peppers in there. A very small amount of them. I didn't even really feel the heat, but just to add the flavor. But the guy that was making it, I've never seen somebody so like the knife was a part of him. He even said me and the knife had been working together 16 years, the way that he talked about it. And he was just chopping. I mean, I'm talking like, you know, you're talking about cutting fish thin earlier. He was doing that with a cucumber and he wasn't even looking. He was just like this, looking everywhere and just ta-ta-ta-ta. And maybe, you know, 2 millimeters thick. Like, I mean, it's insane. Dude was a phenomenal chef. But yeah, if you ever get the chance to try conch salad, Joe, you got to.
Yeah, you definitely have to try that.
Definitely want.
I was on a sailing trip around the Abaco Islands a couple years back, and stopping at the islands is like one of the things that the locals were making, obviously really, really fresh because they just caught it like that day, you know. So that was the first time I had tried it. And honestly, at this point, nothing come close to that at this point. When you get it local and like right at the source compared to like, you know, the Keys or like somewhere else that has it like as an appetizer, you know, it's not super fresh. But getting it in the Bahamas, like the Abaco Islands, when we're on our sailing trip and getting it made by the locals, that was definitely like perfect. You know, like I said, I haven't had it that good since.
Yeah, it's super good. So you talked a little bit earlier about South Dade Skiff. So how did that even come about?
So it's funny. So we have my husband and I have a 22-foot center console, and we really love the flats fishing game. We wanted something smaller. And I had reached out. So we were back and forth. We had looked at a couple different boats. We thought about getting a Gnu, just another like small boat type of scenario, try to get us out on the flats. And then South Dade, we had found through, there's like these Instagram pages, like Tricked Skiff or a couple different skiff, pages, and South Dade had been, shown on there a couple times, and we going on their website, we really loved the bare bones type of setup. Like we wanted something super super light so we can get super super shallow. And I actually reached that, so when we decided we were gonna buy one, I reached out to South Dade and I was like, hey, we're interested in buying a boat. Then kind of started talking shop and seeing what we were gonna want. And they're like, well, we're honestly a little backed up with some orders right now, but we have this demo boat that you can just have right now if you want to just take it. And it's like, okay, sure. It's forever, you know, like here's a free boat basically to just take out and, you know, get it back to us whenever, like we'll just be in touch. So we went down to Miami. They're in like Miami-Dade area, like a homestead area down in South Florida. We drove down there, met the owner. Lewis is so meticulous with building these boats. And at this point, I've gone down there a couple times to watch him in the middle of builds. It's absolutely amazing how many different steps there are to building these boats. And again, he really takes his time with these builds. And again, every little nook and cranny detail, he's triple and quadruple checked it. He has the guys that are helping him in the shop there, and they're making these boats so solid. Like you can jump down from the platform onto the deck and it doesn't flex at all. Like it's really, really solid boats. So anyways, we ended up taking this demo boat home, and kind of fast forwarding to today, we're now on a third different model that they've custom made for me at this point, since they blew up after I was able to get on their boats for a little while. And I think they had maybe like 1,000 or 2,000 followers when I first started working with them, and they're up past like Chittum skiffs. Like they have more followers than like some of these big skiff builders. And he's,
that's awesome.
he's gone through, they've sold, they're almost at 50 skiffs that they've built. The first one that I got from them, I think was hole number like 5 or 6. Like it was a really new company at that point. Mm-hmm. He was just starting to making boats. So, I mean, in the last couple of years, he's blown up. He's gotten all this exposure. He's up there now with these big brands, you know, all these really well-known skiff builders, at least especially with the Instagram stuff. He has just as many followers. He's getting featured on like these magazines and stuff with lists, like right up there with all these other top brands. So I'm really happy for him. It was really a mutual benefit both of us, me being able to get out on the boat, and then he obviously got all the exposure from it too. But
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's been a really good relationship with him. They're like family at this point. I can like call him up any minute and talk shop. And I was actually just texting with him earlier today because we're planning a tarpon trip with his they have an 18 foot now. So they have a 16 foot Southade, which is the model that I have, and then their 18 foot is called the Islandia. So he's gonna be driving up in about a month with the bigger boat, so we can take that out and do some tarpon fishing. So fingers crossed we can get some action. That's on tarpon. Awesome. On the new boat. So no, it's been awesome. It's been really, really cool.
That's so cool. Yeah, the boat that you have right now is freaking sick. I saw it and I was like, oh, that thing. And I mean, I've never been on a skiff like that, a smaller skiff. I've been on you know, a couple of the boats that I've taken out in Louisiana and stuff. But they're, you know, basically bare bones. And yours just looks a lot nicer than the ones that I've been on.
They put a lot of detail in it. And it's what's really cool, because they are still such a small company, that if you reach out to build a new boat, you can custom design every single aspect of that boat, because they're not having to, it's not like a factory. Like it's still like a couple guys are doing these individually. So you get to customize everything from the different types of platforms, what type of motor you want, if you want a jack plate, if you don't want trim tabs, if you want a center console, or I originally had the tiller. I've upgraded to the center console since. Differences with the trailer and all the colors. You get to pick out your boat colors, which is fun. Like the tough deck, the decking on in there too. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways to really customize those boats, which obviously just makes it really fun, because they're all right. Really, really unique at the end of the day.
Different that's designs awesome. On the decking too.
Yeah.
Like that's crazy.
That's so cool. Scales. Yeah, it's really,
yeah,
really
cool. I thought that was awesome, because I've seen the typical, you know, wood looking decking and stuff like that, and then I saw like the tarp scales. It's like, oh, that is so cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got both. That's freaking sweet. And the teak like design, so it's cool.
Yeah, one of my kayaks that I have a Bonafide that has that teak decking kind of pad, and that was one of the things, one of the main reasons I wanted it. And so whenever I went to buy my latest kayak, I couldn't find the aqua color with like the wood grain decking on it. And so I went ahead and got the Venom, which was the lime green with the dark gray. I mean, I liked it, but it wasn't what I wanted. Well, one of my buddies in Texas wanted to get the same kayak as me. And he went to a shop there in San Marcos, Texas. And he's like, dude, they have that blue one. I said, dude, if you buy the blue one, I'll give you my green one if you want a green one. And so he ended up buying it. And like a year and a half later, we finally swapped. And so now I have the aqua one with like the wood grain teak decking on it. It's so sweet. I love the way that looks.
That's really cool. What are you usually catching on your kayak?
I don't take it out as often as I should, but normally I'm out there just bass fishing, so I'll go for smallmouth and stuff like that. I take it out for pickerel also, so okay. Pickerel's fun to catch. We have a lake probably 20-30 minutes away from me that holds pickerel in it, so go out there and catch me some little tiny pike. Actually, funny enough, I've actually never caught a pike bigger than pickerel. So I've caught a 24 and a half inch pickerel, and all the northern pike that I've caught have been sub 18 inches. So I can't really say the smaller cousin, because all the pickerel that mostly pickerel I've caught have been bigger than the northern pike that I've caught. So
that's cool. Well, I haven't caught either.
I like fishing for toothy critters.
Not that on me.
Really?
Yeah, no, I haven't been.
They're fun to catch.
That's really cool. Yeah, that's definitely on my bucket list at some point, is to do some like inshore, like freshwater stuff, even getting up north to like Alaska and doing some like salmon in the river type of stuff is definitely up there too. But yeah, like pike, I haven't caught any, walleye, any of that stuff. I haven't caught any of those.
I do want to catch walleye because table fare, you know, everybody says walleye is one of the best fish to eat out there. And we have them here in Arkansas. I just haven't caught any. The pike that I've caught actually were up in Alaska, but I've never gone salmon fishing or anything. I've only caught trout and pike up there in Alaska. So, but yeah, walleye is one that I do want to catch. And we actually have a dam 15 minutes from my house that holds them, but I went out there. My buddy told me, he said, hey, if you go stand at this point on this rock, throw your fly right here and fish it this way, you'll catch them. And I went out there. It was a Sunday and didn't catch anything. And I fished for probably 2 to 3 hours in that spot, all around that area, nothing. And it was a Sunday. It was like 70 something degrees. The water, like I think it was flowing at like maybe 300 CFS or something like that. And then he goes out there the next day, the same exact spot, the same exact weather, the same exact flow, and caught 18 of them in like 3 hours. And I was like, dude, what the heck? And he showed me the fly he was using. It was the exact same fly that he gave me the day before to go out there. I said, man, it must be something that I'm doing.
Like, it's not meant to be.
Right. It needs to be, though. I want to eat them.
Definitely gotta try that again, though. If he can do it, you can do it. So
exactly. Exactly.
That's awesome, though. Yeah.
So if you could catch any fish, do you have a bucket list fish that you have not caught yet?
To be honest, it's not really a new species, because we were just talking about tarpon, but tarpon on fly, I know we already touched on that. That's up there with the bucket list. Going to Alaska and doing some like salmon fishing. I haven't caught like a blue marlin or a white marlin, so that's definitely up there too. I know there's a bunch of different areas of I'd have to go to get right. different species. I might be doing a California trip to get on some big tuna, so I haven't done that before, so I'm pretty excited to maybe do something new like that. But yeah, those are the main ones. And also doing some like, I mean, your other big fly fishing target species would be like a permit on fly. Wow. I haven't done that yet. Come to think of it, I haven't caught a bonefish on fly either. I've lost a bonefish on fly. But I haven't caught one. Yeah, it was pretty heartbreaking. So that's up there. There's definitely, being relatively new with the fly fishing game, it's cool because like even species that I've caught before, it's just a new level of like, all right, I'm so excited to go out and try to do this a little different, a little harder. And again, like even with the bonefish, like I've caught bonefish before on spinning tackle, but I haven't caught on fly yet. So I'm just as excited about like those species and getting it on fly as I am like white marlin, blue marlin. Although some people may think that I'm crazy for saying that, like it's still just, it's the visual thing. A lot of the fishing that I love is the sight casting, the hunting in a way. If I can see the fish before I catch it, and I can get the fly out exactly where it needs to be and watch the whole eat, that is so, that's a little bit more rewarding than like the bottom fishing or the, oh, I don't know what's on there. Let's see what it is when it gets up to the surface. You know, it's still a good fight, but the visual part of it is kind of what gets the fishing for me, what kind of gets the fishing itch for me. So yeah, so hopefully I'll be able to get some of those fish on fly within the next year or two. I have some cool trips planned.
Nice. That's awesome. Yeah, sight fishing is definitely the thing that gets me going too. I think that's why I've been on a carp kick lately, because you can see them eat.
Yeah, the carp are really fun. Do you guys get those in lakes up there?
Well, I live on Lake Hamilton, on a finger of Lake Hamilton here in Arkansas. And so probably 20 feet from my back door right here is where the lake's at. And it sucks because I can hear them. Like if I don't have time to fish or it's nighttime or something like that, I can hear them out there this time of year just splashing. Sounds like somebody's jumping in the lake behind my place. And it's just these carp going. And somebody told me that what they do is they'll kind of slap their bellies on the surface of the water to help break up egg sacs and stuff. And so you can just hear them. And it's like, oh, I wish I could be out there fishing right now. But yeah, so they're right, you know, not far from my back door. And that's where I've caught a couple of them so far. And it's the sight fishing thing that just gets me going. You see them, you got to make the cast, you make the cast, you see them turn on it, you see the puff of mud, and you're just like, it's on. And then they just take off. Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard people compare carp fishing to red fishing because it's very similar in terms of the take and the way they fight. And me being, you know, 8 hours from the coast, you know, carp is the next best thing, and I freaking love it. And they get big here. I mean, the one that I caught, not this year, but last year, Jose, how big do you think that thing was? Probably close to 30 pounds?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just massive from 50 feet behind where I live.
That's awesome. That's so cool. Yeah, they get big. We get a couple of them down in like South Florida, like around like Miami. You'll find them in like the canals and stuff down there. But they get big. They eat Wonder Bread, you know, like balled up bread. Uh-huh. That's the key to catching those, at least the ones down here.
And Jose's first experience on one was they were eating bread. Weren't they? And then you threw a Lano bug out there?
Yeah, there's a so Russell lives in Arkansas. I live in College Station in Texas. And there's a pond close, well, it's in town. And this was during COVID. Me and my roommate had gone to go fishing, and there's this little pond there. And I never even knew carp were in there. I've only ever caught like some different panfish, some bass, and that's it. And so I kept seeing like something coming and eating stuff off the surface. I thought they were just some panfish. So I made my way over there and I noticed some pieces of bread just kind of floating, but didn't think anything of it because there are a lot of people who go there. They like to feed the ducks or feed the fish, whatever. So I just throw it in there. So I throw my fly and I'm just waiting, and I see these big rubber lips come up and suck down a piece of bread like right next to my fly. I was like, holy crap. And I was just about to recast, and another set of lips comes up and sucks down my Lano bug. And I'd set the hook, and I was using a 3-weight because I was fishing for panfish. And I have no idea how big this carp was, but we're talking about like our longest fights. That was my longest fight. I fought that thing for an hour.
Oh my and, God.
Yeah. On a 3-weight with like, I think it was 5X tippet. So it was like four pound test equivalent, something like that. So I was like trying to really kind of baby it because I did not want to lose my first carp ever. And it kind of sucks because there was a kid there who was watching me, and God bless him. He was trying to help me, but I was able to get the carp in the net, but it was one of those nets that have like the rubber basket, and the carp broke through the rubber basket and fell in the water and took off again. So my line was going through the net. So my plan was to run the rod through the net and then just grab it and resume the fight. But the kid went and he reached for the line. I was like, no, don't grab it. And he grabbed the line and it just popped. I was like, dang it. Yeah, I was so bummed. And I could tell he felt bad. I was like, dude, and I felt bad because I didn't want him feeling bad. It was just kind of a thing. But I was like, man, it's all good. Don't even worry about it. So I went back with a bigger rod, hoping to see them again, and I never saw those carp again. I have no idea what happened. No. So that was like my first experience carp fishing. And but ever since then, like, I kind of got the bug for it. So I started tying a bunch of flies for carp and things. And that same time that Russell caught that big, massive carp, I happened to be in Arkansas. It was his birthday weekend, which is actually coming up. It was his birthday weekend. And so we went. It was awesome. We did a bunch of stuff, but we started, you know, fishing there behind his apartment, and I caught a koi fish that was hanging out with some carp in there, and that was pretty cool. That's been probably perhaps one of the most memorable catches so far on the fly for me. That was pretty. I was losing my mind. Russell was there. You can tell you. I was so excited, but
I came sprinting. I was probably like 50 yards away, and I came sprinting across. I was like, dude, you got it.
We were both just so yelling exciting. And like the neighbors were looking at us like, what are these psychos doing?
And then we pick up a goldfish.
A massive goldfish.
That's cool. No, that's definitely not your average like species on fly.
It's strange because there's like a whole school of them that runs around with the carp out here. Really? There's also the one that he caught, a big was like
tri-colored one, didn't you?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago, and it made me so mad because I had a wind knot because I'm casting overhead. So do you know what a steeple cast is?
I don't.
So if there's stuff behind you, you basically have to shoot your fly straight up in the air and like not much behind you, and then you have to try to lay it forward. And I was doing that on a windy day, standing between a bunch of cattails and then the apartment behind me. And so like I'm so close to it that like if I do a full back cast, my fly would hit the apartments. That's how close it is. Oh, wow. And so I was having a steeple cast at this place and, or for this fish. And I somehow got a wind knot in there trying to learn how to steeple cast. And there was a little knot and I set the hook and the fish went to take off. And when I went to clear the line, it just snapped off. And then I pull in my line and I see that there was a little knot at the end where it broke. I was like, son of a gun.
Wind knots are the worst.
So as you can tell, me and Jose are fly anglers. What was your catalyst into getting into fly fishing?
I think once you get relatively good at doing at least like for a spinning rod, for example, like I am a great caster. Like I can like reach certain points or up underneath mangroves. Like I can do it all on the spinning rod. I think just that next level of something that's difficult or like the next best challenge, you know, like it was just that wanting to get back out there and do something different that was harder than what I was already doing, since I was relatively, like I said, pretty good at it. I was catching the fish I wanted to, like, all right, what's my next challenge? And with around here in Tampa, we get a lot of redfish. So that's been one of the main species that we've been able to target on fly. And it's kind of funny, before I got into all the fly stuff, I was catching snook all the time. Like people would kind of joke around like, oh, you're the snook girl. That's like pretty much all I was catching was snook on topwater, like snook here and there. And that's like, and to me at the time, like redfish was like the elusive species I could never find on like my normal artificial stuff. So being able to target those that on fly was even that much more interesting, because it was just different than what I was doing before. So getting into the fly fishing with the redfish, at least here in Tampa, was my first go-to. And then I've been able to expand from there with other species. But the redfish was the main species I started with when I started to fly fish.
That's awesome. What a species to start with. I think me and Jose both started with panfish and bass.
Yeah, I know, right? And then it's funny because like I started with saltwater. So when I hear people think or say like, oh, you're saltwater fishing with a fly rod, it's like, well, wait, isn't that what you guys do too? Like, I didn't know that was like, I knew freshwater was obviously a really big thing because that's what the majority of people are able to access. But it didn't really dawn on me that like, I'm so blessed that I live in Florida that I'm my first time in fly fishing, it's going to be saltwater, not even freshwater. So, no, it's been really cool. And we've dabbled. I have a lake out back too. So we do our little bluegill and our bass on fly, and then we'll be out there practicing and you just end up hooking up to something. So we do a little bit of freshwater with that, but mostly saltwater. So that's the really cool thing about being here in Tampa. We can kind of do a little bit of both.
Nice. That's so cool.
I know. I miss saltwater fishing so much.
You guys need to come down to Florida.
I know, for sure. We actually have a friend who lives in Florida. He was actually a guest on the episode that we were talking about bow fishing.
Yeah.
And he's invited us. Unfortunately, I just haven't had the time to make that trip. But
have you guys done a lot of bow fishing?
No, never.
Yeah, I did it once and I sucked at it. I shot at 3 gar and missed all 3 of them.
Oh no, they're hard targets. They're pretty skinny.
Yeah. And yeah. I just never had the opportunity to do it. Although, and I mentioned this in that episode as well, that I'm not opposed to doing it. I want to do it. I just haven't had the chance to, under the right circumstances, of course. Right. Yeah. So like, but yeah, I've never done it. I've had friends who they would go to, what lake was it? Amistad, I think, or Falcon, and they would go bow fishing for carp and gar and stuff like that. But they did that for a while. I don't know if they still do it, but that's kind of it. Or is that something like that you and your husband like to do, Erica?
Yeah, well, we actually have a bow. So that's one thing that it has to be like the time and the place for it. Like you said, it's not something we're going to go out and do all the time, but certain times of the year, there's certain species that are better than others to target. So we have a fish. Do you guys know what a sheephead is? I'm sure, like the stripe.
Oh, yeah.
So here in Florida in the winter time, they'll actually congregate around the pilings around docks. And so you'll get a real high tide and now all the barnacles and stuff that are on the pole there, once the tide comes up, they're able to access these barnacles that they haven't been able to before, you know? So they're all huddled up right at the surface of the water, sitting there like kind of sideways too. So they're like perfect, like big dinner plate targets. And obviously you have to visually make sure that they're the right size because you're killing the fish as soon as you shoot it. So you have to make sure you're shooting the one that's big enough to keep. Right. But it's perfect because you can get right. We'll throw the trolling motor in. We'll just kind of scoot along the docks and just slowly like work our way along until we see them up ahead, like sitting on the piling, just sitting there. And they're perfect targets, to be honest, because they're only like this far under the water. You got to aim low because that's the key. Aim lower than you think you have to. Those are one of our go-tos when we're bringing the bow out, is looking for the sheephead on pilings on the high tide. But otherwise we'll do some freshwater stuff. We have some like walking catfish in the lake. We try to get those in the gar, like some like the invasive stuff. We'll try to get that out of the lake if we have good shots. But usually if we do bring it out, it's in the salt water for sheephead.
What's a walking catfish?
A walking catfish, they're actually invasive. And I didn't know what they were either until we feed the fish in the lake. So like we have bluegill and stuff busting and stuff. And these walking catfish came up too. And I didn't know what they were. My husband's like, oh yeah, see, these are, they're walking catfish. Have you ever seen the, you know, when places have real high tide and like there's videos of like fish like walking across the road? Have you seen like videos like that? So that's what these like walking catfish are. They're invasive, but they can literally like live out of the water for a period of time, which is crazy. They can like kind of breathe air in a way.
That's insane.
But they're great targets. they shouldn't be in the lake anyways. So I'm right. All about taking out invasive species if I have the opportunity to. So it became dog food, I think.
Hey, at least nice. You did something with it.
Yeah, we try to repurpose everything if we can, like the squirrels in the backyard, dog food, just little things.
But I just Googled what a walking catfish is. They look interesting, like an eel with like a catfish's head or something. It's crazy.
And the ones we have in the lake are big too. Like you see some of like the ones online, they're pretty small. Like weird. Mm-hmm. I have to look back at that picture, but it was easily over a foot. It was pretty big.
That's crazy.
It's kind of crazy because like Texas has a bunch of not going to use the term invasive, but exotic animals, like four-legged animals and things, but Florida has a bunch of exotic and invasive aquatic animals. Mm-hmm. Like you have those, what are they called? Clown nightfish. You got peacock bass.
Peacocks.
Some different kinds snake of types heads. Of cichlids. Yeah, snakeheads.
And what's crazy is a lot of those, like the freshwater stuff, where you'd usually see a ton of largemouth bass, like you'll go to the ponds, especially in South Florida, and it's like all you see are peacock bass. You know, it's like these invasive species or exotic species have just completely taken over certain areas where the native fish are kind of like non-existent anymore because they just kind of get eaten up. They get taken over by these other species that are just a little more aggressive. They eat all the babies, you know, and before you know it, that's the only thing you have in there. So it's great fishing for people. Right. I mean, there's definitely guides down there that specifically target, like, all right, we're going to go guide for peacock bass. You know, it's like, cool. You get to catch huge ones because obviously that's all that's in there. And they're great bites. They're really fun fish to catch if you guys ever end up being able to get out there to catch peacock bass or clown knife. They're fun fish. Definitely really cool, especially if you're only used to like the largemouth bass out of the freshwater stuff. But yeah, they're definitely have taken over some of those waterways down in like South Florida.
That's crazy. Yeah. That's one thing that I mean, in terms of sportsmanship, like, yeah, I bet it's awesome to catch some of those invasive species, but at the same time, you got to think about like those fish don't belong there. And you got to think about all of the native fish that are now displaced because of it. So it's give and take. Yeah. I feel like it'd be exciting. I would love to catch them. I'm not saying that I don't want to catch them. But it's sad to know that there's areas that don't even have the native species anymore because of these other fish that were introduced. So, but one of our buddies actually just caught some, he's actually going to be on next week, I believe, but he went to Colombia and caught some peacock bass. And I'm like, dude, I'm so jealous.
Cool. That's definitely a bucket list. Actually catch the species where they're supposed to be, you know, like in another country.
Exactly. Exactly. That's kind of how I feel with like even some smaller fish like brook trout. Like I would love to catch a brook trout up in, you know, the Appalachian Trail, Appalachian Mountains, where they belong, you know, heading up closer to Canada. That would be so cool. But if I catch one here in Arkansas, I'm still going to be excited because they're freaking cool looking fish.
That's really cool.
So before we run out of time, would you like to plug your social media and YouTube channel?
Sure. Yeah. So you guys can find me on Instagram and my platform is Erica_Lynn2. Or YouTube, you can just search Erica Lynn. I'll pop up. You'll see my face. And I have tons of videos on there, lots of different fishing, lots of different adventures of all different types of places, scenarios people have been with. And obviously Instagram is a lot of featuring a lot of my current catches. And just, I keep up a little bit more on Instagram with like the stories, and I try to keep up with the homesteading stuff. I know we didn't touch on that too much, but I do a lot in the garden with chickens and cooking and sourdough baking. So there's a lot of that stuff I share on Instagram and YouTube. So you guys can find me on those social media channels. I always have something going on.
Yeah, I've dove a little bit into your homesteading videos, and someday I plan on having a homestead. And so actually, if I'm not mistaken, I think that's actually how I found your channel in the first place, oddly enough, was through homesteading videos, not fishing videos. And then I was like, oh crap, she fishes. And I was like, oh crap, she fly fishes. And so I kind of went down the rabbit hole that way. But I think I actually discovered you from the homesteading. And didn't you do like a canning video or something? Yes. Not too long. Yeah.
Yep. I did all the cucumbers, and we're still going through those cans of pickles at this point. They are delicious. If you guys follow that recipe to a T, like I did in the video, honestly, they're probably the best pickles we've ever had. And we've shared them with family at this point, and everyone raves about them. So you guys can go watch my canning video. I'll show you exactly how to make them. But yeah, we have a huge garden out back with every single vegetable you can think of. I have a ton of chickens. We get eggs every day. I do the whole meat chicken thing. So we get 50 meat chickens from the chicken place that come in the mail. If they just get delivered in the mail. We process our own meat chickens. Those are the last rounds in the deep freezer. We buy a cow every year, or we split a cow with some friends. Cows in the freezer too. So we would try to do everything ourselves as much as possible. So I'm getting as little as I need to from the grocery store is kind of our goal. We're kind of joking around, the last couple of dinners have all been from either got the garden and like the cow, or garden and the chicken. So it's really cool at this point. It took a long time for us to get here, like years to build up the size of the garden and getting all the protein, you know, set aside. But it's really rewarding once you get to the point where all your meals are coming from your own sources. So it's really cool that it just feels so rewarding at the end of the day. You know, you're doing it yourself.
That's so cool.
That's so awesome.
And I could go into more of that, but we'll save that for next time. Yeah,
there's so much. I mean, I go down rabbit holes on YouTube. I tell myself and I tell other people I'm a YouTubeaholic, and I will go down a homesteading rabbit hole. And I travel for work quite often. And so if I'm driving, for instance, I'm driving to Mississippi or something, it's a 4.5 hour drive, I'm going to have the YouTube playing, you know, something. And sometimes it's fishing, sometimes it's homesteading, but I try to focus more on stuff to where I can focus on the road. I'm just listening to it. So that's why the fishing videos aren't as high on the list as like homesteading videos and stuff like that. But I will just go down for hours. It's bad.
Perfect. That makes me want to put out some more homesteading videos for you then. I'll have to work on that this year.
They're interesting.
Yeah, definitely will.
Well, we appreciate you hopping on. We're getting kind of close to the time. We have kind of an hour and a half limit per episode, and we're getting close to that. So is there any other things that you want to talk about before we go ahead and get off of here?
Just that if people are wanting to get out on the water, there's definitely outlets to do so. Don't think that it's like a big hurdle to get out there and get more involved with the outdoors. especially for women out there. I was very big into not wanting to rely on someone else to take me out on the water. So I was finding, whether it's even wading, you know, you get yourself some good boots, and these more like saltwater friends, but get out there, even if you're walking around the water with some boots fishing. I mean, you get a kayak, there's people that you can reach out to and you can hook up with certain charters. So there's so many different ways to get out on the water, especially when you're talking about fishing and things like that. So definitely make a point to get out there, because it's good for your soul, you know, and you guys know, like it's very, it just brings your, I don't know, it's very balancing with your life. Like I personally, like I need to be out on the water and to be in the outdoors to feel like myself. So I feel like more people need to realize that they need that too in their life, if that makes sense. So especially for the women out there, that if I can do it, you can do it. So I would love to see more women in the sport, and just in general, just more people out on the water enjoying the outdoors.
I agree with that 100%. And it's weird because there are a lot of women that recreate, but there are far less women. And to me, I think that's kind of strange, because there's a lot more women that hike, for instance, or there's a lot more women that like to do things outdoors. But when it comes to fishing or hunting, like the number of women that are recreating that way is far less than that of men. And I think that might have something to do with, obviously, historically, hundreds of years ago, men were the ones that were going out and hunting and stuff. But in terms of recreation, outdoor recreation, it's crazy that there's a lot of women that you will be out hiking, and you see, you know, you'll go hike a mountain or hike, you know, here out in the forest or something like that, and you'll see more women than you will see men outside. So it's not like they don't like being outside, but it's just weird to not see very many of them out there fishing. So when I see women out there fishing, I just think, oh, that's awesome. You know, we need to see more of that for sure.
Yeah, I would definitely love to see more women out there fishing with me, just like I said, usually almost everyone I see at the ramp are men. everyone I see out there fishing on boats, or like I said, at the ramps as I'm launching, they're usually all men. But that's all right. I mean, we got to start somewhere. So hopefully I inspire some women out there to get out there and enjoy the outdoors and get out there fishing, get in touch with a local guide. There's usually always seminars. There's things that you can start with that at least learn the basics. Another great option is also YouTube. There's tons of YouTube videos you can watch to kind of get your basics down. And even if you were to go like to a tackle shop or somewhere local that you can get your first setup, like the people that are working there are usually so willing to help you, point you in the right direction. Especially even with guides, like if you're fishing in an area for the first time, pick that guide's brain. He's going to want to tell you what you're using. He's going to want to tell you how to catch fish. So just soak all that information in and then apply it to your own fishing, whether it's back in your hometown freshwater or, in a saltwater scenario. I mean, you can definitely use those same skills and put them to the test by yourself, or with others, you know, but kind of taking that information and expanding on it for yourself is definitely a doable. So you can do it.
We appreciate you getting that word out there, because yeah, it's definitely something that needs to happen more. So, but we appreciate you hopping on. It's been a great conversation. I feel like there's a lot more that we could dive into. There's a lot more to you than what we talked about. So I enjoyed this. So you're welcome back anytime if you ever want to hop on to another podcast, and maybe we could dive more into the homesteading stuff. But we really appreciate you hopping on. And those of you listeners that have made it to the end, we appreciate you guys listening, and we'll catch y'all next time.
Thanks for having us, guys. Appreciate it.
This has been Wildlife Outdoors. Thanks for listening. Follow us on Facebook at Wildlife Outdoors and on Instagram at wild.life.outdoors. Let's go live life on the wild side.